thank you for the opportunity, Troy, and I really appreciate you guys turning up. It's great. Thank you. So Troy asked me to just share some of my story, testimony, whatever you like to call it. So I'm going to do that for a bit and then just unpack what Traders One is all about and why we partner with churches, the vision behind that, and how we do it. And if in any of this you guys have questions, it's a small enough group to just be interactive. So stop me and just ask away. In sharing my story, it's one of being disturbed by God and progressively dislodged from a life of ambition and climbing the greasy pole of a career in the IT industry. What I now recognize to be a life of excess and this kind of constant driving to want more and to be more successful. And there's this kind of loop narrative in my head of all the milestones you need to be at certain points in your life in order to achieve things and acquire things and so on. So that has been my story. About 8 years ago, things started to go wrong with it because God started meddling with me. And I find myself as someone in the middle of a story that's changing like that. And sometimes I have to admit it doesn't make sense sometimes. And when viewed from certain angles, it's definitely one of a downward trajectory and in some ways kind of failure at what I thought I was called to do. And yet learning through all of this that you're following a crucified Messiah who, when he goes to the cross, it looks completely like failure, like everyone's abandoned him. So, this is not false modesty. I still do occasionally wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning with my heart pounding and just thinking, what on earth are you doing living in Santa Cruz, having moved your family over from the UK? You were perfectly happy in a beautiful English village where you knew everybody, your wife was deeply settled, and you had a good job and kids were happy. What on earth do you think you're doing? So I kind of have those panic attacks about once a month. Used to be 3 times a week, but they still happen, and I'm learning to just have confidence in a Father who knows me and who has provided for me and just blessed me in ways that I never thought imaginable. So I'm getting to learn more about God and learn who he is and how he deals with me through that story. So I started out life as a missionary kid. I was actually born in the UK. My brother was born in Bombay. My parents were on Operation Mobilization, if you know that organization, OM. Really crazy kind of Jesus freaks. We lived in India. We've lived in Iran, Afghanistan, Beirut, like all over the world. Some of my formative years, my father did kind of inner city missions, and we were in Brixton in London. And in that short time, I think 18 months, he was trying to convert some of the gang leaders and just work with the gang members. I was shot once, he was shot once, our car was stolen 3 times. We got it back those 3 times because all he needed to do was go to the local gang boss, put his arm around him, say, hey, our car disappeared last night. It'd be great if you could find where it is and just bring it back. We always got our car back. We had a maximum security prison just across the road from us, from which prisoners escaped, ended up in our house. My father wrestled them, pulled them out. It was a really rough inner city mission type of thing. That wasn't crazy enough for him, so we ended up in Iran doing evangelism to Muslims, Shia Muslims. And I remember as what must I have been, 11 years old, going to Qom, which is the holy city of all of Shia Islam. And my father, in retrospect, this is a really dumb idea of my dad, but we went to Qom. I think he thought he was going to do some open evangelism in Qom. And anyway, I was given the tracts, and he said, whatever you do, don't give these out unless I say it's okay. Well, we got separated, and of course, this mob of men surrounded me, interested in what I had. I had a whole pile of tracks, and so, you know, they insisted I gave them, so I got rid of them all. And I remember seeing my father, you never usually see your father run, but I remember him running straight for me down the street and just kind of grabbing me by the collar and having to run as fast as we could towards the van, jump in it before this whole mob descended on a van and tried to overturn it. He just about started in time and we made our way out. I'm sure we would have been killed if they'd got hold of us. So a pretty crazy upbringing, even down to Bible smuggling in Eastern Europe, where, you know, I would work as a 14, 15-year-old in the garage where we would cut open cars and put Bibles in the seams of the cars and then weld them back shut, fill them up, paint them over, and then I would actually be the bait because I was this innocent little 14-year-old in a car that we would then drive across the border and then, you know, deliver Bibles. So I've had a really pretty unusual background as a missionary kid. But through that, saw, you know, just amazing examples of the providence of God. I remember in Brixton, I'm wanting a TV and saying to my dad, you know, all the kids at school talk about TV. It'd be really nice to have a TV at home. And I remember his response was, look, as your father, I don't have the money. I'd like to give you a TV, but I just simply can't. So if you need one and God thinks he agrees with you, then he'll give it to you. So ask your heavenly father, not your earthly one. So I said, well, could I pray now then? So he goes, yeah, sure. So we pray, and the next morning, and this is not because he went out and did this, the next morning there's a TV on the front doorstep saying, if you want to use this, we're getting rid of it. I remember seeing things like that. I remember in Iran at the age of 11 or 12, my father gathering the family around the table, just saying, and this is before the age of, you know, faxes and emails and instant knowledge of everybody around the world. We were in Tehran. The supporting churches were in America, and we were out of money. And I remember him gathering us around, just saying, we don't have anything left. I don't know what to do other than pray. So as a family, we need to pray, but we have absolutely no money left. But God will provide, but we need to pray. So we all prayed, and the next day, I remember him able to then say, this arrived in the mail. Guys, look at this. This supports us for the next year. And just seeing one example after another of God's amazing providence. And then as an adult, deciding, I don't know, for whatever reason, that's just too dangerous a life to lead. You know, living that far out on the edge, waiting for God to turn up every time, and if he doesn't, you're completely hosed. I just didn't feel I had the stomach for that. So decided to go into business myself after a brief, just 1 year in ministry after university, where it kind of went pretty badly wrong. I loved what I did. Worked for one of the largest Bible teaching churches in the UK, and just had a whole year of the senior pastor teaching me how he preached, how he studied. It was just a wonderful year of learning from him. But in that whole process, I was exposed to a lot of really ugly politics within a church and decided, this is not for me. I'm out of here. And honestly, people, I have huge respect for the jobs that you guys do. After seeing the kind of graciousness that he had to exhibit, and the ugliness that came out on the inside from a church. So I decided that I'm not cut out for that. I'm going to go make money. Went into business, and so went into the IT industry. And just increasingly, God became less and less relevant. Still went to a pretty good expository Bible teaching church, but the teaching really increasingly didn't have any relevance to my daily life. So kind of 80% of my waking life, what I heard in church really was pretty much irrelevant. So I just went down the track of earning more money, you know, $5,000 watch, you know, the obligatory red sports car, all that kind of stuff, lots of share options, and basically traveling way, way too much, probably 6 days a week of work on long-haul flights once a month. And, I mean, you can write a script for where that life ends up, right? So about 10 years ago, just went back to my boss and just said, I can write a script for where this is going to end up, and I don't like where it's going. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm either going to work, you've got me doing about 3 jobs for you, paying me basically about 2 salaries worth of money. I'm going to do 1 job for you, and the job that I think I can do well, and I can do that 3 days a week, and I'm going to take a huge pay cut. But that's what I'm going to do. If that's not possible, then I'm going to leave, and I don't know where I'm going. So after peeling him off the ceiling, where he explained that everybody has to work 65-hour weeks, and this is just what it's like in this industry, and you just got to grow up, I didn't say, well, you're on your 3rd wife, my friend, and your alimony payments kind of make you feel like you have to earn that much money. We actually have become really good friends as a result of the honesty that we've been able to share since that point. Anyway, so I then deliberately pulled back, tried to free up some time to just listen to God again, and went back and read the Gospels again, read theologians I hadn't read before, like N.T. Wright and Walter Brueggemann. And I couldn't really understand how I get to that age and miss good news to the poor and freedom to the captive and recovery of sight to the blind, justice, righteousness, and compassion issues in the Gospel. I had been brought up with this pretty strong, conservative, evangelical theology that said it's all about how to get to heaven when you die, and everything else is a very, very distant 2nd or 3rd issue to that. So became increasingly fascinated about recovering this other aspect of the Gospel. And as a business guy, started asking, well, how does good news to the poor, freedom to the captive, relate to business? What's it got to do with business? And got involved with a group of people in the UK called the Transformational Business Network, really passionate business people, passionate at seeing business being used amongst the poorest of the poor to create jobs. And for the first time in my life, was able to realize, oh, there were jobs in the Garden of Eden before the fall, and so the absence of work is a missions issue. That's interesting. So just providing a dignified job, particularly for the poorest of the poor, that could be missional. Like I hadn't even considered that. So I found that really interesting and increasingly fascinating. So with my 2 days a week that I'd taken off, ended up going on a couple of trips, visited about 25 different businesses on the front lines of HIV/AIDS, sat with women who'd been taken out of human trafficking, out of commercial sex work, heard their stories. They are now employed, given dignified jobs, making things. Just really got so excited about seeing the whole transformation, even the physical transformation that can happen amongst the Dalits, the untouchables in India, who are stooped over, they won't even look you in the eye. And yet after 5 or so years of being able to buy her own cow and pay for it and have a dignified way of earning a living, you just saw a physical difference. They were able to stand up and look you in the eye and have that dignity. And more of that Imago Dei shone through than they were ever able to experience without that. So a good friend of mine that I met there in India, my wife and I were then increasingly starting to think, well, maybe this is the direction God would be leading us, and should we move to India and help? And a friend of mine that I made there said, whatever you do, Nathan, please don't come out to India. We have plenty of foot soldiers in the fight against poverty here. Your role should be as a catalyst. And just, I don't know what that means, but just you go figure that out. So as I went and met with these groups that are working amongst the poorest of the poor and just listened to them, I really didn't have anything other than I want to have table fellowship with the poor, and I want to hear their stories, and I want to hear what they need. And I would always say at the end of the meeting, what is it you need most? And almost every single one of those 25 said, we have no way, we're not very good at marketing, we can't get our products to market. One of them that I met just outside the red light district in Mumbai, a wonderful husband and wife team. The husband would work actually with IJM and do undercover investigations of the trafficking rings and the brothels, and actually work with law enforcement. Really dangerous work, both spiritually dangerous and physically dangerous for him. And she was running this organization, this company that was employing the prostitutes that had been taken out of the red light district. And I remember her breaking down and crying and saying, "I feel such a failure, because it takes 12 months for us to give these women aftercare and teach them that God loves them, that they're princesses, they're daughters of the king, and then teach them a job, and all they've ever known is working in a brothel, and it's hard work to learn how to learn these skills, and then it takes 12 months to do this, and then I employ them for a month, and then I lay them off because I've run out of cash, and I just feel a failure." And I just thought, how could God allow that to happen? Like, here's a couple right on the front lines for you. How can you allow that to happen? And I progressively began to see that God does not allow it to happen. I think our complacency, our unwillingness to change our consumption habits is what leaves her in the situation that she's in. Through seeing 25 of these businesses, got introduced to the whole movement of fair trade in the UK. And it's interesting, in the UK, fair trade is a Christian response to poverty. It's pretty much a grassroots church-led movement. You cannot swing a cat in England without hitting a church that does something about fair trade on a Sunday, or lobbies for it, or sells fair trade stuff in their church. I mean, it's just part of the fabric. And yet, in a country where, I don't know, 4% of the population go to church, there's only about 2 million people who go to church in the UK. And yet, over the course of the last 40 years, that weak church, has, I think, spoken prophetically to the marketplace. I was amazed when I went back last year. About 78% of the British public know about fair trade and take part in it on a regular basis. For about 3 decades, really the only way to buy fair trade was at your local church, once a month or once a week. And then the fair trade company that kind of led that movement, Tradecraft, found for-profit, publicly listed company, founded by 3 Christian nonprofits, tried to get its products into the mainstream supermarkets. Every one of the mainstream supermarkets said, "Forget it, go away. What do you think it says of our sourcing practices? We've got 40,000 SKUs on the shelves, and one of them says fair trade. What does that say about our sourcing practices of all the other 40,000? Go away." Anyway, they were really smart. They got one of those supermarkets to break ranks and just try it for one weekend. And they had this really great kind of Cliff Bar, energy bar type of product. I forget which supermarket it was. So they said, "Well, on one weekend, we'll stock it and we'll see how things go." So they put it on the shelves. Tradecraft, having been founded by Oxfam, CAFOD, and one other, Tier Fund, I think, in the UK, they had a mailing list of about 1 million people. So they just said, "Don't buy your Geo bar from your church this weekend. Buy it from Safeways," or whatever it was. So they emptied the shelves. All their software said, "This is a good product to stock." They were really clever about how they went around doing this. Anyway, it's now got to the stage about 7 or 8 years later where this is mainstream. I saw people, as I checked out of supermarkets, "Have you bought fair trade?" as labels on the checkout women on the store. Kids running around. I mean, these are not Christians. Kids running around with T-shirts saying fair trade T-shirt, no slave labor involved. As I was getting involved with the fair trade movement in the UK, still working for my software company on a part-time basis, traveling for the most part all over the States, I became increasingly interested in, well, wow, there's 2 million people who go to church in the UK, and there's 100 million people who go to church in the US. And yet wherever I go, nobody seems to understand what I mean when I say, "Do you know what fair trade is?" And at first that kind of upset me, and then I thought, wow, that's a huge opportunity. I mean, it's 100 million people in the largest consumer economy in the world that could be given the vision of connecting their faith to the way in which they spend their money, this could be really significant. So it's a, wherever I would go on business, I would always slope off and meet a missions pastor of a church or a senior pastor of a church or a evangelical thought leader or author or something. And I would always ask, could the church in America get engaged in fair trade, do you think? And every single one of them, and I took about 10 dipstick readings, just said, no, it can't work. You need to understand, we had this big bust up in America between the liberals and conservatives 50 years ago, and liberals do social gospel, conservatives do evangelism, no one does anything in between. I actually had a mega church pastor, this is a church of 25,000 people, look me in the eye and just say, and I think it was with sadness, but he said, you need to understand, Nathan, Americans are consumers first and Christians second. And you will never get many churches to back you in undermining the consumer economy. And we know this, and this is why we've got a very successful church, but that's just how it is. So it's not going to work. I don't know whether it was God's calling or just bullheadedness on my part, but I sense that this is what God would have us do. Rather than move to India, move to the US. So in 2006, my wife and I came over with our three boys, and because Silicon Valley was where I did most of my business, we just kind of thought, well, if you're going to set up a fair trade company, it's probably going to either be on the East Coast or it's going to be on the West Coast. And so we know Silicon Valley, let's go see. So we came here for about 3 weeks just to see if God was opening any doors for us. Went away from that time really not hearing anything clear from God, but also feeling, well, if we're walking down this road and God hasn't slammed a door shut, then maybe we should just keep going. And at this time, I should have said, I'd already gone to my company and said, okay, I'm done. I'm resigning, and I'm going to go to America and start a fair trade company. So at that point, they just went, okay, this is clearly midlife crisis. You're a bit young to have it, but it's clearly hit. And so what we're going to do is put you on 6 months sabbatical, unpaid sabbatical. Just go do your Zen thing, and then you can, once you figure out that you can't make money at this, you can have your job back, and we'll all be friends again. So I was on a six-month sabbatical at that time. We came out in April of 2006, decided as we got back to the UK, and I think God would still have us to go back to my company and say, no, we're really not coming back. And I was almost physically sick at that point. I remember that evening just thinking, this is it. What I'm doing is taking my career and putting it on an altar to God and cutting its throat. And I don't know how this is going to turn out because I haven't made a pile of money. I'd done all the spreadsheets. I can do those spreadsheets and figured out, well, it's going to be 12 months and then I'm completely out of money. I don't really have a plan here, but I think the next step of obedience is to just say we're not coming back. So anyway, I phoned up my CEO, and he spends 50% of his time in Atlanta, 25% of his time in the UK, and the rest in Asia. He's not in the country. His secretary says, well, I'll give you a call when he's in the country, and it's likely to be in 6 weeks or so, and you can meet with him. So I'm traveling on this train going into London, reading this book on how to start your own business, which is how unprepared I was. And I get to this chapter on risk, and it said any Muppet can pack in their job, remortgage their house, jump into some venture they think is going to change the world. Most people fail, and one of the major reasons they fail is they don't manage risk adequately. So here's some suggestions. Number one, eat humble pie, go back to your previous employer, get them to support you in some way, because this is your richest network of connections. And I would not tell a lie in front of pastors, right? As I'm reading those words, we're pulling into a train station. I didn't even know he's in the country. The CEO of the company gets onto the train and sits right next to me and says, hey, Nathan, I hear you want to meet. What's going on? Are you coming back or what? Now, and this guy is a hard-charging, sales-driven CEO. I mean, I've watched grown men actually dissolve with tears in front of their peers if they are not prepared to answer questions that he asks of them, and he can drill deeper and deeper and deeper and humiliate you if you're not prepared. So I am not ready for this conversation in any way, And it predictably goes down the road of me saying, yeah, I am leaving, and I'm, well, so what are you going to go do? Well, it's called fair trade, and really, so tell me about it. What's your plan in the States? Well, I'm going to partner with churches. You're going to do what? So what's your research said? Well, everyone thinks it's a bad idea. Okay, what's your cash burn rate going to be? I don't know, but I think it's going to be roughly $15,000 a month. Okay, how are you going to be capitalized? My own savings. Okay. Do you have any lead customers right now? No. Do you have any lead partners? No. Have you got any lead churches to support you in this? No. So I've got like really bad answers to every single one of his questions. And I'm getting in, it's a crickety old train, and we pull into London. And what happens at the end of a conversation like that is Nick tells you what a loser you are and that he never wants to see you again. And normally you're fired. But in this case, obviously, he couldn't fire me. And instead, what he said was, okay, this is what we're going to do, Nathan. You are so unprepared for this. You are taking way too much risk. These are his words. You're taking way too much risk. This is what we're going to do. You're not leaving the company. You're going to stay as an employee. Have you any clue how much it costs to live in Northern California just to survive? No. Why don't you go do your maths and figure out how much money you need on a monthly basis just to survive? Do you have any idea how healthcare works in the United States? No. Why don't you go do your research? Because you're not going to be able to afford it. So this is what we're going to do. You tell me what that number is every month. That's going to be your salary. You're going to keep your share options. I'm going to move you and the family to Silicon Valley. There's something I need you to do for me when you're there. It may take a day a week. It may take a few hours a week. I don't really care. But in the meantime, you can start your business. When it can pay you a salary, you can leave. If it folds, you can have your job back. But right now, you're taking way too much risk. You need a safety net underneath you. So I had to phone my wife and say, now it's an act of disobedience not to go, clearly. So this is like Nehemiah in front of the king. Like, why are you so what's going on? Why are you so upset about this stupid wall around Jerusalem? Okay, well, if it means that much to you, why don't you just go? And yes, you can take some wood and tree, and I'll send some people to help you. And whatever. This is Nehemiah in front of the king. And I'd never had experiences of my own, stories like that, to be able to tell. So we came out, and the first 2 years were just horrific. We lost a lot of money, as predicted. Really couldn't get any churches to partner with us. And I got to the end of the second year, and just before leaving the UK, in fact, the night before, I remember waking up in a panic attack, a pressure on my chest, feeling like I was going to have a heart attack. I don't know if you've had those panic attacks before, but with a real clear, this is like 3 o'clock in the morning, just before we fly, a real clear sense of we will be returning to England in failure and with one of my three boys in a pine box. It was like really clear. And those first 2 years were just like predictable. I'm a nobody. I'm a complete unknown from a village no one's ever heard of in England. Why would anyone partner with you? And so I put out this fleece at the end of 2 years and said to God, look, okay, I don't know why I thought this was a good idea, but it's going badly wrong. So here's a number. This is how much revenue we need to make this year for me to consider this blessed and for me to carry on. So there you go. If I don't get it, I'm going home. And we missed it. And so went back to the board in January and just said, okay, it's over. We're going to wind this up and we're going home. And so one of the board members just said, well, it's going to take you 6 months to wind it up. So just don't do anything precipitous right now. Let's just see whether God has something else in store. Well, at that time as well, my wife is coming home from school with our youngest, who's six. They're on a crosswalk. All the cars have stopped, so she says he can go across. He skips across, and this car hasn't seen her, speeds up, hits him, flies 20 feet in the air, smashed up face, brain hemorrhage, broken leg. Like, she picks up she's sure he's dead, just picks up his body, and this is the pit. And I don't know why God takes you through a pit like that when you've responded through obedience to something. But it was like, why have you left us to this? Just the lowest point. And went back to the UK, prayed with the group from our church there, small church, who had commissioned us to go out and just said, it's over, just can't explain it, just feel really stupid. So they said, we don't feel the same way, so you've got 12 more months, you've got to give it another 12 months, and we really feel that you need to move from where you currently are, find somewhere that the family will flourish, because they're not flourishing where you currently are. We're right in the heart of Silicon Valley. And let's just see whether the business flourishes as well. So we did that. We moved to Santa Cruz. And about 2 weeks later, I get a phone call from, you know, one of the biggest churches in the country, from Willow Creek. And they said, we're going through a whole month of teaching our people to consume less and give away the excess. And we also want them to use their spending power for the kingdom, and we know it's got something to do with fair trade, and we'd like you to come and teach our people about fair trade and hold a fair trade sale. Would you like to do it? So I had to say, well, wait, let me think about it. Yes. So we did that event with Willow Creek, and as a result of that, of course, lots of other churches hear about it. It kind of gives you, you know, well, if Willow thinks that's the thing to do, it's okay. So for better or for worse, that's just the way it works. And that, together with moving the family to Santa Cruz, Vintage Faith has been a huge part of the flourishing of the family too. Just things started to change, and we saw God turn up in amazing ways. Just so grateful to see and to have partnered with churches since, and people like Mark Labberton. Just churches who have, over the last 4 years, just faithfully partnered with us. They're not into the next big thing. You know, I do partner with huge mega churches, and for the most part, I have to say, what happens is they put Nathan on stage. It's a nice show. He's got a British accent. He's reasonably articulate, and then they can go buying some nice jewelry and feel good about rescuing a couple of women from human trafficking. But once they've done it, they've done it. Like, we did that thing last year. We're on to something else. And there is not that fidelity and commitment to justice and righteousness and faithfulness and a kind of thought-out way in which our lives need to change. And so I shouldn't be this cynical, perhaps, in front of pastors, but I really treasure those churches that for the last 4 years have just partnered year in, year out with us. And one of the greatest joys I have is just unpacking my passions and my convictions for how justice, righteousness, and compassion should be informing every area of our lives, and not simply making us write checks to go and let someone else fix the problem. We should be writing more checks. We should not be giving 3% of our income. It should be at least 10%. So I'm not saying we shouldn't be giving money, but I'm saying that other 90% needs to be up for grabs somehow. And we need to be known as a people who practice strange economic things. Sabbath was strange to people outside of Israel. Sharing all things in common in the early church was strange. The Jubilee laws were strange. The gleaning laws were all strange. God seems to, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? God calls Abram out of the high-growth economy of the day in Mesopotamia. And then he rescues Israel from the high mighty power and growth economy of the day in Egypt. And he takes them to a land flowing with milk and honey, and then he gives them laws that would guarantee that they could not have a high growth economy. You have to forgive debts every 7 years, set all the slaves free, give the land back to the original owners. It's like, we have got something structurally, fundamentally wrong in how we're living our lives here. And I think as a people of God, we need to be modeling alternative, strange economic practices that preach good news to the poor and preach justice to a skeptical world around us. And the beautiful thing is, I believe once we start to do that, it is a compelling thing that non-Christians look at and go, I want to be part of this. This is crazy. We did just at Vintage this last week, we kicked off a series on justice and compassion. And I preached there, and to have non-Christians turn up and hear an articulation of the gospel, which is much more like Eugene gave us and much less like this is how to get to heaven when you die, there's this deep resonance within non-Christians. They've been waiting for this. And to have those conversations on Sunday night was just such a joy. Anyway, so that's part of my my story. I'm sorry, my son. He was in intensive care. The brain hemorrhage didn't do any damage. He's okay now. He has a traumatic tattoo on just underneath there with a bit of road embedded in him, which he can decide whether he wants to get rid of when he's of age. But otherwise, he's fine now. Very bright, and I think brighter than me, actually. So I do keep forgetting to tell the rest of that story. And it's always a mother who asks. So that's kind of my story. It's just so wonderful to be in the presence of Eugene. Just a year ago, I went away for 2 whole days with a long obedience in the same direction. Just felt like I spent the time alone speaking with nobody except having Eugene speak to me. And through the Psalms of Ascent. And, just at that point was questioning, do you want me to shut this down? Because we can't make critical mass. Still 6 years into this, my wife and I still haven't paid ourselves a salary. And there's lots of aspects about this where I look at it. I'm in the IT industry, right? So I know what big, fast, successful means. It isn't just an American concept. And I know that I'm not meeting those milestones in my own business with Traders One. And so I'm constantly being nagged about where's the sustainability? How is this going to be successful? Where is the impact? And it is just so helpful, again, to hear Eugene just say, this is about a walk of faithfulness, and it is not about this idolatrous pursuit of success and largesse and grandiose. So I find myself having put a lot of effort into specific ways in which we partner with churches. So I would love to go through, just take you through some of this. I probably don't need to go into this much more. You've heard me say it. So here's the thing. 100 million churchgoers in the United States, $2.5 trillion in annual spending. 25 million people would be lifted out of extreme poverty if just 1% of the Christians' spending was fair trade. And the beauty is, this is not charity. There's an old African proverb that says, the hand that gives is uppermost, but the hand that shakes is unequal. And this is why I believe in fair trade so passionately. It is a model of engaging the poor that treats them with dignity and treats them as equals with us, and that we have a lot to learn from them and they have a lot to gain from our excess. It is not about pity, and it is not subject to compassion fatigue, because they have to compete in the open market. The products have to be just as good as anything else on the shelves. And when I say that, it reminds me, I promised you chocolate. So I'm going to send these things around, open them up, break things off, help yourselves. This is good chocolate. So this is made by Divine Chocolate. It's a for-profit, publicly listed company in the UK. All of the cocoa beans are harvested by Kwapa Cocoa, a cooperative in Ghana. Kwapa Cocoa owns 35% of the equity in Divine Chocolate. They have a seat on the board. Someone flies from Ghana. One of the farmers flies from Ghana to London to take board decisions every year. 35% of the dividends are redistributed back to Ghana. This is in addition to the fair trade premium which that cooperative receives as a result of selling their cocoa beans through fair trade terms. So it's nothing to do with charity. This is a sustainable business model that gives dignity to the poor. Jobs in the garden. Where is that harbor seal? Josh?
We're going to have a showing tomorrow.
Josh was my guy. He was going to get the harbor seal. I probably don't need to go through the biblical basis of fair trade. What's interesting, I've only ever heard James 5, 1 to 6 preached on once in my life, and I've heard more sermons than I've had hot dinners. But now listen, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that is coming upon you. Your wealth has rotted, moths have eaten your clothes, your gold and silver are corroded, their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the innocent one who is not opposing you. Such strong language from James. And it is very dangerous of us to think that this speaks to somebody other than us who, by any terms, geographically, historically, whatever, we are phenomenally rich. Could go through a whole seminar on how the processes by which our products arrive at our door result in a lack of transparency and exploitation of people who have no power to get us products that we expect to be given to us as cheaply as possible. I mean, do we really think that if you buy a t-shirt for $1.99 that the earth has been treated with dignity and that people have not been enslaved somehow? I don't get it. So engaging our spending for the kingdom, we do a lot of what we do around the last quarter of the year when lots of churches are doing alternative gift fairs, when people just simply are buying a lot of gifts for Christmas time. And that's great. It's a really intense season for us. But outside of that, we will often partner with churches on events around the issue of human trafficking, where people, when they get exposed to this, just get really upset and they want to do something. And usually, the call to action is really unsatisfying. It's usually, well, get your checkbooks out and write a check to IJM and give it to them and they'll go fix the problem or they'll do something about it. If you want to, you can volunteer some of your time in this way, or you can write to your senator, but it really is not a satisfying response. When we start to say, there's a way to build justice and righteousness into our consumption habits so that when you invite somebody around and you pour olive oil over a meal, and you can explain the story behind this olive oil, or you can give them some chocolate and explain the story behind the chocolate, there is a way to build justice into our everyday lives that not only gives dignity to the poor, but allows us to be prophetic out to the marketplace and to model a life that's really, really attractive to non-Christians too. So we do lots of events where, issues of human trafficking or extreme poverty, clean drinking water or whatever, we can always find products that tie, make the connection between the issue that is being talked about and that product. So I'm just going to briefly go through a bit of this. This is just a short video that kind of unpacks what we do. That didn't work very well.
You know, it's strange, but the more stuff we get, the more entitled we feel. We become preoccupied, busy, driven people. We lose all sense of gratitude, and our generosity disappears. And we're reduced to being just consumers. We live in this system that ruthlessly targets us, that manipulates us, and before we know it, enslaves us. And meanwhile, half of the world's population lives on less than $2 a day. And no matter how gifted, intelligent, or hardworking they are, there's no escape. They don't have access to jobs, to resources, to justice, or even to clean water. They have little education, and nobody they know can help. Now, what if an answer to our problem could also be an answer to theirs? What if our spending could actually be used to fix problems instead of creating them? What if the money we spent could save a life? With fair trade, small changes to our spending habits here can transform whole communities there. We get things we need like coffee, olive oil, chocolate, soap, bags, t-shirts, gifts, all made by the poor who now earn a living wage, made sustainably and made without slavery or child labor. What they get are jobs that bring them dignified work, that break cycles of dependency, and that free them from abuse. Churches all over America are partnering with Traders One to mobilize their people to buy fair trade and be good news to the poor. Their purchases have brought dignity, stability, and hope to some of the darkest places in the world. And think about this, if every person who attended church in this country made just one fair trade purchase, 1 million families would be lifted out of poverty for one whole year. So join us, your spending can change lives.
So that's usually the video that we use in the churches that we are present in. So briefly, what is fair trade? I think I probably don't need to go into this in too much details. There's basically about 9 principles of what constitutes fair trade, but it's basically including the marginalized and treating them with dignity. The definition of fairness is loving your neighbor as yourself. and so it's how we would like to be treated, but applied to people who, in a lot of cases, wouldn't even have the chance of a sweatshop job. I mean, in a lot of cases, these are very vulnerable and damaged people. So that's fair trade. A number of marks that you will sometimes see on the products. Here's the Kwapa Cocoa. This is in Ghana itself. Examples of, I was staggered. And I went back and found peer-reviewed papers on this, but something like 7,000 small-scale farmers, cotton farmers in India, were committing suicide every year because there was no way out. I mean, 7,000 a year for about a decade. And so this organization, Hey Now, buys their organic cotton. It's really good quality cotton. They can't afford the pesticides. Turns it into t-shirts, imports it into the States. The screen printing is done by an organization in San Francisco that works with at-risk young guys, takes them out of gangs in San Francisco and teaches them and does screen printing. So I just, you know, the whole product itself has a great story behind it. Hagar, this is in Cambodia. This is actually the factory that Nestle abandoned when they pulled out of Phnom Penh. Hagar, which, by the way, I think there's a men's trouser company. It's nothing to do with that. This is founded by Pierre Tammy and his wife about 15 years ago, called Hagar because it specifically targets women with children, single mothers with children who've been physically abused. Many of them have been sold into sex trafficking and either kicked out because they are considered useless or have been rescued. And they make bags. This is... That's not going to work. Just 1 minute to hear Sane's story. I don't know how many times I've seen that and it still makes me cry. She says, and now I'm brave. It's such a... It's so right. God, when he interacts with human beings, tells them not to be afraid. And there's so many things that she had legitimately to be afraid of. And when she says those few words, when I was young, I was sold. In Cambodia, that means probably at the age of 13 or 14, she's sold into a brothel. She's put in, held in a room, chained like an animal until the person who bids the highest for her virginity then rapes her for profit. And then she is progressively, every single day, for the rest of the time that she's in that brothel, servicing between 10 and 30 men every single day. And she just chokes when she says, when I was young, I was sold. I told the story of Elizabeth at, this was at a conference, at the Global Church Conference at First Pres Berkeley, that IJM had rescued. She was a Christian. She was sold as a 10th grader into a brothel. And she was sure God would not allow this to happen and said to the other girls in the brothel, I will be rescued inside of a year. 3 days before the end of the year was up, with local law enforcement, IJM came in, raided the brothel, got her out. Above her bed was the first verse of Psalm 27. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life, of whom shall I be afraid? The next verse, when evil men advance against me to devour my flesh, when my enemies and foes attack me, they will stumble and fall. The 10th verse of Psalm 27 is, even though my mother and my father abandon me, the Lord will receive me. The poor read the Bible in a very different way to us sometimes. Anyway. Didn't intend to go off track there. And it affects us too. This is at a church in Atlanta. We just gave the opportunity for people who bought the products made by, all the products were made by women taken out of trafficking, to write notes back to them. And I thought we'd get, 10 or 15. We got something like 250 notes. And you realize, Jesus takes the side of the poor, not to condemn us rich, but to bring us into inclusion with the poor, because we have so much to learn from them too. And these two things, you can tell it's in Atlanta. Y'all have done a great job sharing the beauty of Thailand as well as the sadness and oppression over that nation. Thank you for sharing this message. The more informed people there are, the less time it will take for a new world to begin. And then, I have never made a purchase for a better cause. As a victim of child and sexual abuse, I am grateful for your efforts to proclaim freedom to the captive. So how can your church get involved? I should probably, if I was smarter, spend more of my time on this. But here are four ways that you can do this. One of the challenges that I have learned these last 6 years in engaging with churches is partly the kind of consumer mentality of, we've done that this year, we don't want to do it next year. And so one of the things which we've changed is we've introduced this program called Change for Good, which a lot of people, from the very first time we started doing what we did at Traders One, they would come up and say, well, it's fine to buy a piece of jewelry made by someone at Hagar, and I'll do that next time you're back at my church in a year's time, but what do I do in the meantime? What about all the other products that I buy every day? So my wife and I have always done CSA, Community Supported Agriculture. Do you guys know what that is? Okay. So, you support a local farm, you write a check for a whole season, and you just pick up your vegetables every week. So we thought, there were so many people just saying, look, I'm there, okay? I want to support you. I believe in what we're doing as a church. Just make it easy for me. So what we've done now is kind of take the CSA model and said, okay, if you want to do that, then just buy a year's worth of subscription, or if you want, just one season. And every 3 months, we're going to send you a box. And this is what the box looks like. I know you can't really see it. But all sorts of different consumables. So like olive oil and sugar and chocolate and rice and tea and beans and soap and stuff that you're going to consume during the 3 months. And you get to learn the stories of the people behind it. So it connects you with them, too. You get to learn different recipes that you can try. And if there's something in there that you don't really like, you just take it around to your friend's house when you go around for a meal and give it as a gift and tell the story behind the product. And that way, kind of share it that way. So we're really excited about Change for Good, and it's a real simple way for a church to say, here's a connection between our faith and building justice into our everyday habits. And so if you want to, you can find out more about this. I've got cards here. I've also, before I forget, I've got lots of these things. So this basically unpacks what I'm about to go through. And then we have another program called Hungry for Change. So that is where, in solidarity with those on a dollar a day, and you know, there's a child that dies of malnutrition once every 5 seconds. So what we do for 5 days is you have nothing to eat except for what's in this box. That's it. So you get oatmeal for breakfast, rice and beans for lunch, rice and beans for dinner. It's roughly about 400 calories a meal, lasts for 5 days. And what you do is over those 5 days, there's emails that are going to be sent to you as you go through this. They're written by a wonderful friend of ours, Stella, in Malawi. She's Ugandan, single mother. She's adopted 3 HIV-positive children. One of them has since died. But she writes an email to you on the subject of sacrifice for those 5 days. It's like, it's a really profound... I've gone through fasting, and I've done it for just 24 hours. But to go through a kind of like an extended fast for 5 days, I was able to get into conversation with God about things that just don't happen on a one-day fast. And so it's a way of... So the idea behind it is you then go back and look at your budget and figure out what you would have spent in 5 days. And it's pretty shocking, actually. And then you just give that to the church. So it's meant to be a group experience. A church does it together. And it just releases money in real generous ways. And the beautiful thing is it's not giving. You're basically taking money out of Safeway's pocket and appropriating it for the church. And then as a church together, you go and do something with that money, some specific project amongst the poor. So that Hungry for Change experience is a real powerful one as well. And then you could hold an alternative gift fair. There's a lot that happens in November, December. And so if you wanted to do that, we've got ways of doing it where we don't have to ship a ton of stuff to you and, you know, have cash registers and everything else. We've figured out how to do it in a really efficient way using the internet as well as some kind of samples. And then a lot of churches then say, well, once they've done that gift fair, they have what we call a trading post, so they'll take the kind of best-selling products and just have it. In fact, there's some here in the bookstore at Mount Hermon. So it's just a small group of products that will be in the coffee shop or the bookstore or something, just so that fair trade can then be part of the kind of daily or weekly rhythm of the church as well. So that's what just explained those two things. Oh yeah, the Change for Good costs about a dollar a day. That's what you commit to, and you get all these other things. There's church events. There's a trading post at a church in New Hampshire. Some of our church partners. I get really excited about partnering with a church. People still tell me I'm completely stupid doing what I'm doing. Like, forget the church. They're not going to partner with you in any way that you're ever going to be sustainable. Just make yourself a secular fair trade company. And I won't do it. I mean, I've had a bust up on the board about this, and a board member has left. I've just said, I'm called to do this, and if I can't make this work, then I'm going to go do something else, but I am not going to make this a secular fair trade company. Because I believe so much that the church needs to lead in this area. When I came here 6 years ago, it was so clear. Fair trade as a movement in North America, for the most part, is seen as a pot-smoking hippie, leftist kind of crunchy Santa Cruz thing to do. And if you're a church, certainly if you're a conservative evangelical church, you wouldn't touch this with a barge pole. And yet, I've got conservative evangelical churches in the heart of Texas, in the heart of the Midwest, partnering faithfully with us. Really excited. I can talk to dyed-in-the-wool Republicans or Democrats. This cuts across politics. There's just something right about this that people know is right. And the other thing that's most exciting about this is when a church uses this as a way to engage the local community as well. It's almost like tapping a gusher. That's what we experienced at Vintage Faith in Santa Cruz. Really, just a lot of the people around the city then wait for this thing to happen every year, and we have people from outside the church come in and take part, and it's really exciting. But let's not, as a church, be late to the game in this. I think we are, but when the church moves, it amazing things can happen, as we've seen in history. So that's all I've got to say. If there's time for questions, yeah. I'd be delighted. We have a website. So the question is, do which companies, like Divine? Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, so every product on our website, and there's something like 700 of them, every one of them, you can read the stories behind it. You can find, there's transparency. You can find where we source them from, who we buy them from, and you can read the people's stories.
If we do this at the church, do you have press releases kind of prepared to help us out with getting word to the community and such?
We have done those, yeah. And you know, if I happen to be there as well, would love to just get the word out there. However, I mean, like if you've got local radio or something, we've done that too. Just getting it out in the community is just a fantastic thing. So yeah, do press releases. What we did with one church was we printed 4 professionally printed cards for every person who attended the church. And said, these cards are invitation cards to an event, and they're not for you, they're for your non-Christian friends. Go give them out. And the pastor and I then had a discussion on stage for about 25 minutes at this event. And I said, because this was in Berkeley, of all places, right? So you can't even swing a cat without hitting someone who's going to lecture you on fair trade in Berkeley. And so I said, we're late to the game. And it deeply pains me to admit this, but when Christians talk about fair trade, let me unpack some of this. So we told some of the stories, and we were able to push into this area of it's not simply economic justice. You can't just release someone from human trafficking and just give her a job and it's okay. There's a whole person that needs healing, and we believe that includes the spiritual side of it as well. And people have become Christians, they've started coming to that church as a result of it. So creative ways of doing that is just wonderful.
Have you worked at all with Fairtrade Healdsburg? It's the 23rd city in the United States that the city council has just recently said we're going to be a Fairtrade
town. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's. I think you're right. Thank you. Well, yeah, let's talk afterwards. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I'm Christina Sachs. I'm married to this impassioned man. And I'm a justice advocate for IJM. And I just came back from Washington, D.C. For a global prayer gathering. Exploitation, illegal seizure of property, sex trafficking, smuggling of people, etc. That's really to free miners from Russia. Mm. And they also release indentured slaves from their films and other places that are keeping families, generations of slaves in other countries. So I'm grateful
great.
That you're all here.
Thank you. Go ahead.
We have a project in Santa Barbara on the west side, and it's called the Villages by the Karen Foundation, and I'm there a lot. And the people that I run into, and the people that I love and care for, they're my friends that are marginal people, have so many of the same needs that you have just mentioned in other parts of the world. They're so fearful, so when you tell another American person they have it unless they really trust you. And I don't know, I mean, I do feel global about lots of things, but maybe it's because I'm on, in the part of the city that you would think was so lovely and lovely.
Hmm. Yes. So the question is, there's brokenness in America, and just as you're giving jobs to somebody in Thailand, what about here too? I think, is that right?
That's great.
So, I agree. So this is one, Marianne's black bean soup mix, from Denver in Colorado, working with battered women, who now have a job making bean soup. Amongst a lot of other things. They do a really great job. And it's not just a job, you know, they're looking after the women there too. So I agree. Now, you know, there's living in Santa Cruz, it's in your face how much brokenness there is in America. And as a European who comes to America and sees a lot of this, it's kind of shocking. But I agree. There is a lot of brokenness that needs fixing. It's not all global. You know, having said that, you have to try pretty hard to watch three of your children die of malnutrition in North America. You know, there is a degree of extreme poverty that is, you have to smell what $1 a day means. You have to step over the syringes and the condoms and the feces and the slums with the children running around barefoot before you really get it. Like, that level of grinding poverty is... absolutely. The principle applies here too. And we do buy from organizations like that.
Do you have your own travel itinerary anywhere where you would maybe know where you are and search time to just be back?
You know, it isn't. It's pretty intense at the moment, and I haven't published it anywhere, but I could.
Know when you're in an area.
Yeah. You in San Diego?
Yeah. Sorry.
I can make San Diego in an hour and a half.
We do the alternative Christmas market. We're one of the largest amounts of money given through ACM in the whole country.
Wow.
We're up at about 125,000. I'd love to piggyback on that.
Yeah.
We've had that consciousness for about 12 years.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Well, make sure we connect, and I'll make a trip.
Early when you started talking, you mentioned in your own experience that about 80% of what you heard in the church just wasn't relevant. Mm. Do you think that in the evangelical church, the boundaries of what's acceptable to are too narrow?
The boundaries of... Unpack that a bit for me.
We pastors don't really get into justice. This stuff that you presented to us. We do Bible studies.
Right.
We exposit the scriptures, but we have our blinders on.
Mm.
And it's partly because if we got into some of this stuff, we might discover our people are getting a little testy because they don't like having something that they felt was maybe a little politicized or something like that.
Mm. My mind goes in two different directions. One is, the gospel is justice. I mean, it's not a separate, it's not a hole that you can plug. Jesus' healings is bringing the Father's justice to a broken creation that is groaning. His acceptance of the whores and the misfits and the children is like saying, I don't accept these man-made social divisions of who's acceptable and who isn't. His atonement is God's, it's all justice. And we've made it about how to get to heaven when you die, and then this kind of footnote on personal happiness and success, and then a smaller footnote on spiritual experience, and then justice is somewhere else. And I think as a church, we need to uncover a much more holistic understanding of justice, compassion, tzedakah, righteousness, and preach that. I do notice a difference in churches that have had that, and it tends to be the ones that IJM is partnered with. The theology happens to be kind of right. The seeds have been sown, and it's a different kind of engagement that we have than a church that's just getting into this. But I would say also, you know, as a business person, what really turned me off is the message that I got was, okay, your job as a businessman in the church is to be as least toxic as you can be, witness occasionally to people in whatever job you're at, and give as much money as you can to the church. It wasn't a very high view of what I was doing in my life. And so when I could uncover this connection between jobs in the garden and being a missions issue, suddenly my ability to read a balance sheet, take business risk and whatever, I could start to draw a direct line to the kingdom of God. And that isn't kind of typically taught in churches, that as well. So I would encourage that too.